You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. What is happening on the U.S. West Coast where fossil fuel companies race to export carbon to Asia? Let's tune in with a longtime friend of the environment, Daphne Wisham. For 8 years out of Washington, D.C., Daphne hosted the syndicated radio show Earthbeat on the Pacifica Network. Her articles have been published by both mainstream and alternative media. Now Daphne is in Portland, Oregon, as the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. At the same time, she's an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Daphne, it's so good to hear your voice again on Radio EcoShock. Welcome back.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's great to be here.
You and I were just on post-carbon radio on KWMR in Northern California with Bing Gong and Karin Nyhus. It was a wide-ranging talk. I'd like, in this instance, to drill down to what's happening in Portland, the state of Oregon, maybe the Pacific Northwest, when it comes to transporting fossil fuels. Are you up for that?
I sure am.
All right. Why don't we start with Portland? What battles have been fought there recently against becoming a dirty carbon outlet?
Well, one thing that people may not realize is that not only is Portland, Oregon, a very hip city, it also happens to be one of the first cities, the first city in the United States to put in place a climate action plan. Back in the early 1990s, Portland decided that it really needed to take the climate crisis seriously. And as a result, the city has largely been ahead of the curve for the rest of the country and has a reputation, in fact, was recognized by the White House as a so-called climate champion just last December. Despite this reputation, or perhaps in addition to this reputation, the mayor decided that it was going to be a good idea to invite one of the biggest tar sands pipeline operators in the Canadian tar sands, Pembina Pipeline Corporation, to set up shop in Portland's harbors. And they wanted to export propane from the terminals here in Portland. He welcomed them with open arms. A lot of us began to organize, cried foul. And at the time of this interview, we seem to have won. We're reluctant to completely declare victory because this corporation has bottomless pockets and is doing all it can to fight back. But we waged a campaign both based on both safety issues and climate issues and generated thousands of letters and had very creative involvement from a wide array of folks here in the city, including Raging Grannies and bicyclist activists and people taking over city council hearings. And we finally got our message across, and it appears that Pembina is not going to be welcome anymore in the city of Portland. We want to use this victory, though, not just to say not in our backyard, but also to alert people to just how insane it is to be pushing forward with fossil fuel infrastructure in the Pacific Northwest, given the imperative that we begin to ratchet down our overall greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the Northwest, but globally. And to draw attention to the fact that the Pacific Northwest right now is in the crosshairs of the fossil fuel industry. They want to export 5 times the carbon that is now being proposed for the Keystone XL pipeline through our ports in Oregon and Washington. And very few people are aware of just how serious this hazard is to our economy, to our beautiful rivers and lakes and forests outside of the Northwest. Of course, here we're all up in arms and trying to take on one proposal after another as it comes down the pike. So rather than just playing whack-a-mole, which is sort of what a lot of groups have been doing, you stop one project, it pops up another place, we've decided to declare a ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure, starting in Portland and then moving out to the rest of Oregon and the rest of the Northwest. And we should be getting a hearing over the coming year by city officials around this call. We want no fossil fuel exports and no new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city. So that's our campaign, and I think we have a pretty good chance of winning it.
Yeah, it would be such a different story if you were exporting solar panels in bulk or wind machines.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we would love to be doing something along those lines. And in fact, that's the vision that Portland's Climate Action Plan today calls for, which is, you know, again, way ahead of the curve, trying to push for bikeable and walkable cities, drastically reducing greenhouse gas emissions, increasing public transit. So it just doesn't make sense. We found that the emissions from just this one propane terminal alone over several decades would be larger than the entire city of Portland's emissions if our emissions were to continue to go down. So it just didn't make sense from a climate action perspective to be proceeding with this terminal.
Right. It's almost like changing your light bulbs at home, but allowing a coal plant to be built next door. So as you know, billionaire Warren Buffett is having a hard time finding a place to unload his coal trains for shipping to China. What have you heard about new coal ports in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, you know, there have been quite a few proposals for coal export terminals in the Pacific Northwest, and almost all of them have been defeated. We have two that are still on the table, one in Longview, Washington, and one in Cherry Point. Both are for over 40 million tons of coal exports per year. The one in Cherry Point, Washington, is on Native American land, on Lummi land, and they are fighting and waging a very fierce battle against that coal export terminal because they argue that it would violate their treaties and would affect their fisheries. The other proposals that have been tabled are up and down the Columbia River have been withdrawn essentially by the investors over the past 5 years. It may have to do with the fact that coal increasingly has become less and less profitable. We also suspect it has something to do with the fact that these very same terminals began to look attractive for oil export. As soon as we get rid of a coal terminal, an oil terminal is proposed. In fact, the largest oil terminal in the entire United States is being proposed right across the river from Portland in the city of Vancouver, Washington. And that battle is now being waged between, on the one hand, there's a plan for a major development right on the riverfront that a lot of people are very excited to see happen with, you know, condominiums and businesses right along the river. And should this oil terminal get built there, that project will not go forward. So there's a lot of tension between those two different types of development that are being proposed. But, you know, over and over again, these oil, gas, and coal corporations are using very sneaky tactics. They'll claim, for example, one of the ways that an oil company managed to get the Bakken crude managed to be exported along the Columbia River, they got a port claiming it was going to be used as a biorefinery. The biorefinery went bankrupt. And then once they had already gotten the code amended for the biorefinery, they changed it to an oil terminal. So there's all sorts of tricky schemes that these industries are using, outright lies, claiming that they are, you know, for example, in the case of the propane terminal, they claimed it was going to be used for, you know, women to cook with in Asia. We found out, in fact, it was going to be used to be making propylene and plastics. Had nothing to do with alleviating the poverty of poor women in Asia. So, you know, we have to be on our guard against these companies. They're using every strategy they can. Oregon apparently is number three nationally as a target for ALEC funds. That's one of the right-wing anti-environmental and climate denialist groups that's been pushing a very strong legislative agenda in favor of big energy and big oil. And so we're really fighting on all fronts here in the Northwest.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, whenever big oil money comes into an area, there's a chance for corruption, and certainly you can woo politicians with the ideas of more jobs and a better economy. And eventually, I wonder, is it even compatible with local democracy and freedom in your area to allow these companies to come in and start working the way you're describing?
Well, that's the big threat, I think, that's looming for our region is, you know, it potentially will change not just the political nature of this region, but, you know, the entire economy is shaped in a completely different direction when you start welcoming in oil trains and coal trains and terminals and refineries. Suddenly you start looking a lot more like Texas than Oregon, both politically and environmentally. And that's certainly not what a lot of people move to the Pacific Northwest to experience, and those aren't the values of the Northwest. But, you know, we have, in addition to the traditional political concerns, there's also, of course, the concerns that Native Americans have around preserving their treaties, a concern as they go to court and try to get these treaties upheld. For Native Americans is that in some cases, if they lose, their treaties get weakened. So it's at great risk that they go to court and try to get these treaties upheld. And that's another potential setback that, unfortunately, once again, Native Americans have an awful lot to lose in these battles.
This is Radio EcoShock with our guest, the longtime Green Radio host and activist Daphne Wysham. Another big fad, you know, Daphne, is to announce massive liquid natural gas terminals. We've got a government in British Columbia that got elected promising all the jobs and the money and our budget would be totally balanced once we get these LNG plants, which have not materialized, incidentally. What about LNG in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, that's another big battle that we're facing right now. We've got two major pipelines being proposed just for Oregon, one in Southern Oregon that they want to build. It's over $7 billion pipeline that they want to build through the southern part of Oregon and then have the export terminal export LNG from Coos Bay, Oregon, and another one in Northern Oregon in Warrenton, Oregon. And both of these projects would involve, of course, massive acreage and land, a lot of it in private hands. And in many cases, they are claiming eminent domain as an argument in favor of, for example, paying about $12,000, $13,000 per acre, which is way below market value to landholders. And the irony in this is that many of these LNG companies are actually foreign-owned, and they're claiming eminent domain, which is, and of course, it's for export. So a lot of people that are resisting these LNG terminals are saying, you know, how can they possibly be using a law that was created to develop infrastructure for people in the United States, taking our land away from us in order to facilitate the profits of foreign corporations that are just bypassing all of our legal structures in order to build this pipeline and export it to other countries. So there's a lot of resistance, but again, with so much money on the table, a lot of politicians are lining up to support this. And certainly our local paper, the Oregonian, seems to be completely in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. They've written editorials saying that climate change is not a concern for Oregonians and are regularly trumpeting all the benefits of these fossil fuel exports. So we're in a bit of a, you know, in a bit of a war here in the Northwest in terms of both keeping people informed about what's really happening and taking, you know, holding our elected officials accountable.
Does the state of Oregon allow fracking?
No, it has not banned fracking. This actually did come up this year that there was a bill that originally was going to ban fracking, and then it sort of morphed into regulating fracking, and that created a huge uproar where people said, no, we don't want to regulate it, we want to ban it outright. Currently, there, as far as I know, there's very little in the way of any sort of gas, exploitable gas reserves anywhere in Oregon, but I think they would have an awfully hard time fracking in Oregon.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, Daphne, I know you continue to keep track of U.S. national policy as well. What do you make of President Obama taking, you know, he talks strongly about climate change and then he approves exploration for more fossil fuels in the fragile Arctic by Shell Oil?
You know, your guess is as good as mine, Alex. I'm just mystified, you know, how he can take, especially of late in his last 2 years in office, where I think he's felt much more free to speak boldly about the climate crisis and seems to be taking an awful lot of opportunities to speak out on it, why he would, on the one hand, take these, you know, take these actions to, for example, restrict coal-fired power plant emissions and increase energy efficient, fuel-efficient automobiles, and then at the same time allow for Arctic drilling and massive oil and gas and coal exports. I suppose it may have something to do with the fact that he was the number one recipient of BP funds when he was running for office. I don't know if he's still feeling beholden to his donors. It's really hard to understand why he is acting the way he is.
And again, on the international front, I was disappointed the leaders of the industrial countries, the G7, could only promise an end to carbon emissions by the end of this century, 85 years away. That's way too late to avoid catastrophic climate change. What do you think?
That's right. I mean, we had a proposal that was the Germans of the G7 were trying to get a decarbonization of all of the G7 economies by 2050. And the Canadians and the Japanese pushed back, allegedly, and said, no, but we will sign on to decarbonization by 2100. Of course, this is a non-binding agreement, so even if it were 2050, it wouldn't be all that exciting. But 2100 is so far out, you know, past the lifetime of any of these folks at the table that I'm sure they felt very comfortable making this agreement and kicking the can down the road. The Japanese apparently are very heavily invested in coal-fired power in Asia, and so that explains their reluctance to see any decrease in their investments in coal. And I suppose the Canadians, due to the tar sands, are reluctant to see decarbonization anytime soon. But you seem to suggest, at least in our last conversation, that tar sands profits are plummeting. Is that right?
That's true. It's just too expensive to produce the tar sands. You need at least $60 to $70 a barrel to do it, and they're only getting about $40 to $45. They don't get world prices because the tar sands requires so much work at the refinery to get a usable product that they get a lower price. So they're losing some money, and what's happening is there's massive layoffs in Alberta, and I mean big, big, big layoffs, and the financing for these companies is getting hard to get, and their stocks, according to one of our guests, went down 70%. So that's a big drop in their stock value as well.
Interesting. Well, that may be that may explain why they're trying to also some of the same companies tap into the fracked gas in Alberta and the propane byproduct of fracked gas that in the past had been treated as a waste gas. It's another revenue stream for them.
Yeah. Now, do you expect much concrete to come out of the Paris climate talks later this year?
Well, I'm always hopeful. I have to say, I haven't been. I went to the climate negotiations in Kyoto, and I went to several others after that, and I haven't been to the last few years because I was just feeling very discouraged about all of the brinksmanship, and which is what you always see at these conferences. Nobody shows their hand until long after midnight on the final night, and then finally everybody's scrambling on very little sleep to come up with an agreement. And it just seemed like a game of chess with the fate of the planet at stake over and over again. I found it very tiresome. This time, you know, we do have China coming to the table with an agreement with the United States that does seem to have potentially at least broken a logjam between the developing countries and the wealthy countries that we saw over and over again played out at the climate negotiations. So it seems that the dynamics could be different enough to potentially shift things moving forward. But whether we'll see the kind of truly dramatic commitments that are needed to stabilize the climate anytime soon, I'm not that hopeful, but I do think that things will at least begin to shift at this next set of talks.
Now, America has elections coming up eventually. Do you expect the same rogues gallery of Republican climate deniers to be elected again in Congress?
I think the Republicans have a very slim chance of gaining the presidency. I think they have higher likelihood of retaining control of the Senate and the House when you have somebody like Hillary Clinton running for office. I think, you know, just given her stature nationally and globally, she probably stands a greater chance than any of the other candidates that are running, but a lot could happen between now and 2016. That's my prediction at this point in time. We're also seeing Bernie Sanders surprisingly gaining on Hillary Clinton. He's an independent and a self-proclaimed socialist, so that's a huge surprise for the United States. I think what it suggests is that people have had enough of either candidate really avoiding the issue of income inequality, and Bernie Sanders is taking on the corporations and the banks like no other candidate is right now.
Yeah, I remember after the financial crash that Bernie Sanders actually came out and described who runs America, and it was revealing. He talked for hours and hours and hours on the record. It was great stuff. Well, I see that scientists say climate change will look very different from region to region, and we saw that again this year in North America with a hot, exceptionally dry west and a cool, snowy, or rainy east. Is it a big problem that citizens experience climate change so locally, and yet the problem demands a global solution?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Pacific Northwest, one of the things that we are preparing for, which is a little bit alarming, is a major influx of climate refugees to the Northwest. City officials tell us that they're expecting, you know, the population of Portland, for example, to increase by several hundred thousand in the coming decades. So I think, you know, as California dries up and continues to dry up, we probably will see quite a few people moving north from California to wetter climates. Is it problematic how climate change plays out with regard to, I don't fully understand what you mean by that question. Can you reframe?
Well, it's just that, you know, the old story about the elephant, people come up the elephant and one pulls the tail and says, that's what an elephant looks like. And the other one grabs an ear and says, that's what the elephant looks like. Climate change is kind of like that. You know, you have people who see and experience things so differently right around them. And yet they're supposed to all unite somehow and demand an overall great big solution.
Well, I mean, I think the polls suggest that a majority of Americans do think that the climate crisis is serious, it's happening, and they want to see action taken on it. So regardless of how it manifests in their region, I think people are increasingly alarmed and are increasingly wanting to see elected officials take action. Unfortunately, our elected officials are, you know, largely following the money, and most of the money is with the Koch brothers and the other oil companies. So they're listening to them and not to the American people, at least at the moment, you know, and this is one reason why we need better campaign finance laws in this country. But I think what we've come to the conclusion here at the Center for Sustainable Economy is that working at the city level, working at the state level, you can get a lot more done than you can trying to work in Washington, D.C. Things are very broken in Washington, but you can actually affect policy at the state level, and eventually, hopefully, you can piece that into some sort of national strategy.
That's a great point. Are you getting re-energized by regional activism on the West Coast versus the politics of living and working in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, yes, yes. Lots and lots of exclamation points after that statement. I am so inspired by so many of the young people, the retirees. The level of engagement here in the Northwest around the issue of climate change is so broad and so sincere and so energized. It's really inspiring to see. A lot of people have literally, you know, just put their careers completely on hold and are doing nothing but working on this climate crisis. One of the people that's leading the local 350 chapter here in Portland is a former MD who just decided this is where she needed to spend her time and energy. I know a lot of people that have dealt with either early retirement or are living very frugally so that they can devote a significant amount of their time to working on fighting the fossil fuel industry here in Oregon. So it's both inspiring and encourages me to work even harder, whereas back in Washington, D.C., you would just feel that no matter how much you threw your head against that wall, you would just keep smashing it over and over again, and it wasn't going to budge. But things do actually get done at the state level.
I wonder if there's a story or experience beyond that that you think could help raise our listeners to an even greater move into climate activism.
Well, I mean, I think the climate crisis, as you know, you've covered it so well, especially in your recent shows with climate psychologists and others talking about the ways in which we turn away from just how serious it is. It can have that result, but it can also, when you are working in coalition with others, what I found is that the people that end up coming out to join these coalitions are some of the best members of our society. I mean, they are just smart, committed, funny, creative, and these are the kinds of people that I would want to have by my side fighting any kind of battle. So I encourage people that are in any way feeling defeated by this crisis to turn that sort of intention to mourn into an organizing intention and to really seek out like-minded folks, because they will energize you and keep you going in your darkest hours. And a lot of us are feeling the grief around this. I know I've felt it for quite some time, but there are signs that people are really beginning to get it and are really getting mobilized. For example, I'm working with the National Unitarian General Assembly that's gathering in Portland, and 6,000 members of the Unitarian faith are coming from all over the United States, and they'll be focused exclusively on both climate change and also how best to work in solidarity with Native Americans in facing down this crisis. It's very exciting. It feels like we are going to go back to our home communities and really commit to respond. In fact, there's a website, Commit to Respond, and people are going to be asked to do something along the same lines of what your last guest asked us to do, which is to mobilize towards a World War II type mobilization to save humanity. I think a lot of us recognize that that's what's required at this point in time, and we need all of us to be calling for the same thing, both for our economy and for our planet, if we're going to stop this monster in time.
Our guest, Daphne Wisham, hosted the environmental program Earthbeat for 8 years on the Pacifica Radio Network. Now she's bounced between regional activism on the West Coast and her continuing watch over national and international climate developments. She is the director of Climate and the Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. Daphne, where are the best places to follow your ongoing work?
Sustainable-economy is our website, and we are getting our Climate and Energy Program up and running there. We're very excited about a new initiative that you can see an update on shortly called Climate Risk Bonds. We have our preliminary paper up there, and we'll be posting a lot of our activity on LNG and other oil and gas and coal exports in the Pacific Northwest. We've hired a new political director. You can join our activist network there, and we look forward to engaging with anyone who wants to preserve what we call the thin green line here in the Pacific Northwest to prevent these massive fossil fuel exports from going forward.
Great. So listeners, just Google Center for Sustainable Economy or look for links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Daphne, thank you so much for joining us again. Please keep in touch as you develop more stories.
Thank you. And just one last thing. The easiest website, SEEN.org, will take you right to, SEEN.org, will take you right to our activist network page.
Beautiful. SEEN.org. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.